This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, from Bush to Obama to Trump, you can always count on U.S. presidents to keep the war machine humming. We'll speak with Professors Gerald Horn and Francis Boyle, and we'll hear some voices for prison abolition.
But first, Houston, Texas, America's fourth largest city, was sent reeling by Hurricane Harvey. Many tried to escape the storm, including Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. We caught up with Dr. Horn in Atlanta, where he had found refuge. He said danger lurks in Houston's water and in the ground.
Well, there's a threat of cholera, obviously, and other kinds of waterborne diseases. There are more snakes, and I'm not talking about the human variety. I'm talking about the non-human variety that apparently are surfacing underwater, because a good deal of the city is still underwater. Apparently, there are 500,000 cars that have been abandoned, and it'll be quite a task to enter those vehicles to see if there are any bodies in those vehicles, and likewise for the homes that were abandoned as well. Obviously, this has been a major catastrophe, a catastrophe that was exacerbated, according to certain sources, by the constant danger of climate change, which may not have instigated Hurricane Harvey, but according to these sources, helped to intensify it. And then there is the heedless development that's taken place in Houston over the years, over the decades, which has included building on floodplains, which has included a zoning light, regulation light approach to building construction, which has included building on wetlands, which suggests that concrete has replaced natural earth, and natural earth would be better in terms of absorbing all of this water that has been dumped in Houston and the Gulf Coast generally. So to a certain extent, this has been a so-called natural disaster, but to a certain extent, it's been a crime, a social crime, in terms of people dying as a result of capitalist development, in terms of the evolution of right-wing politics. And of course, that latter phrase captures the irony, if not hypocrisy, of Senator Ted Cruz and other GOP leaders who railed against providing aid to the Northeast in the wake of Sandy a few years ago, and now are going with their begging bowls to Washington, demanding aid in the billions for Texas. Also, it's important to note that this Gulf Coast catastrophe has a direct link to the other major story of recent weeks. I'm speaking of the Charlottesville tragedy, the march of Klansmen and neo-Nazis that wound up killing at least one protester and injuring many others. What I mean is that in Houston and in the Gulf Coast, there's this mania against government, even though, of course, now that people, or some people who were echoing that mania, have lost their homes, they're looking to government for a remedy. But it's important to note where that anti-government mania comes from, and in part, it comes from Dixie. It comes from the fact that after the U.S. Civil War, there was the largest uncompensated confiscation of private property in recent history up until that point in 1863, 1865. That is to say, when the property in slaves was abolished with no compensation to the slave owners. In a capitalist society, if you want to generate fury, you take someone's property, even if it's human property, without compensating them. It was the U.S. federal government that presided over that act, which might fairly be called a revolutionary act, but it infuriated the former slave owners. And I think it's fair to say that what's euphemistically called the lost cause should be recharacterized as the lost fortunes, because that's what was really at play. And when the lost fortunes in the form of Africans were then walking around neighborhoods and in the minds of these former slave owners acting impudent, insolent, and cheeky about the matter, this only intensified their fury towards black people generally and also towards the federal government. That led to this repudiation, this attempted repudiation of black people by constructing these monuments to the so-called Confederate States of America. Fast forward to August, September 2017, and that anti-government mania, and indeed that continued fury towards black people, continues to rock this nation. Recall that in the past 24 to 48 hours, a lawmaker in the state of Georgia, is where I'm now sitting, threatened a black woman lawmaker in the state legislature, saying that if she continued to rail against these Confederate monuments, she might go missing. In the state of Missouri, you had a similar incident where a lawmaker threatened those who were protesting Confederate monuments that they might be hanging from the nearest tree sooner rather than later. I think, obviously, that kind of outrage not only calls for censure, but perhaps expulsion from official bodies like state legislatures, but it should also remind us that there are those in this country who still harbor the virus of hatred and bigotry. And until we develop a serious approach to that particular disease, that particular catastrophe, I dare say that we'll continue to be rocked by other kinds of catastrophes that make Harvey perhaps seem like child's play by comparison.
Well, we know that that fury against black people resulted after Katrina in the depopulation, large depopulation of blacks in New Orleans. Historically, in cities all across the country, land that is low-lying and next to industrial areas is where black and brown people live. Do you think there's any threat of mass depopulation or displacement of black and brown and poor folks in Houston?
That is a danger. That is a clear and present danger. And unfortunately, Houston, in terms of its black leadership, unlike Detroit or Chicago or New York or even Los Angeles, for example, which has a black leadership that's not only comprised of middle class elements, that is to say, pastors, doctors, lawyers, small business owners, but because of the growth of trade unionism in those aforementioned cities, they have a working class black leadership that oftentimes can voice the needs and desires of the black poor working class. Whereas in Houston, which is in the heart of red state country, the buckle of the Bible Belt, as is oftentimes referred to, unions are not as prevalent, which means that black working class and poor people do not necessarily have the voice that they might have in other locales. And what that means is that leadership is tipped towards the interests of middle class elements, who oftentimes have more economic wherewithal to survive this kind of catastrophe. And so that does present a clear and present danger along the lines of what befell New Orleans, which also is in a anti-union territory, which means that we're going to have to redouble our efforts to make sure that history does not repeat itself.
You seem to be saying that in Houston, like in New Orleans, poor folks can't depend upon the black misleadership class to come to their aid in catastrophes like hurricanes.
Well, I would say it's an open question, because what's happened in Houston has cut across class lines and to a degree has cut across race lines. The kinds of scenes that you saw in New Orleans, you saw similar scenes in Houston, but I would venture to say that the swath of destruction was cut through Houston encompassed various elements of the social strata and of the racial makeup of that particular city. Given that, and also given the amount of money that's flooding into Houston, I haven't done a calculation, but just from scanning the press, it does seem like there's more money flooding into Houston after Harvey than into New Orleans after Katrina. Now, that may have something to do with the fact that Houston is larger than New Orleans by several orders of magnitude. It's more developed, number one. And then, of course, it's part of a state that's the second most populous for California. So there's just more money generally floating around in Texas and in Houston. And with all of that money floating around, there is a possibility that the poor and the black and brown will fare better in Houston than they fared in Katrina. But that's not a done deal. That's not a slam dunk. It's just a possibility.
Houston's would-be benefactors in Venezuela are themselves facing a catastrophe, not a natural one, one that's being orchestrated by the United States with new and potentially devastating sanctions.
That's true. And you might have noticed that a Russian oil giant has offered to buy some of Venezuela's interests in the United States, including Citgo. You may see their billboards all over the country, including in the city of Boston. But Washington is threatening that deal because it involves two of the current antagonists, or so-called antagonists, I should say, of Washington, speaking in Venezuela and Russia. That would be unfortunate if that kind of sanction were executed, although it would not necessarily be surprising. I think that we have to keep a careful eye on what's going on in Venezuela because it can have ripple effect throughout the region. Already we see that the right is on the march in Brazil. And when I'm speaking of the right, I'm not only talking about the current chief executive, President Temer, but also those far to his right who are fairly could be called fascists, who are now beginning to raise their ugly heads. And likewise, you see that there has been a field of opportunity opened up for meddling in Ecuador, given the current fracas, the current dispute between the president and his vice president. That's made to order for Yankee interference. So I think that solidarity with Venezuela is needed now more than ever. And hopefully there will be voices in our community in particular who reach out to Caracas and offer to work with Caracas in terms of that offer of a generous donation to help some of our folk who are suffering on the Gulf Coast in light of the devastation of Hurricane Harvey and its aftermath.
Yes, there was a time when folks could say or predict with some degree of confidence that if the United States used military force, which it's threatening to use, against Venezuela, it risked setting the whole continent afire. But the right, as you said, is on the march in Venezuela's neighboring countries.
That's true, and things were not helped, I'm afraid to say, by the recent visit to the region of U.S. Vice President Michael Pence, who on the one hand was trying to soften the bellicose remarks of the 45th president, who of course raised the specter of military intervention. But at the same time, if you look at his itinerary, you could fairly infer that he was engaged in meetings that could easily be interpreted as helping to further the bellicosity of President Trump. This is a clear and present danger to the region. And quite frankly, with the United States now reeling from the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, the last thing this country needs, to put it mildly, is yet another military intervention. Not only that, But Mr. Trump, as ever, is pleading inconsistent counts. What I mean is, on the one hand, he's threatening ever more military misadventures, be they in Venezuela, be they in North Korea, be they the expulsion of Russian diplomats from San Francisco, be it the rather apocalyptic words of his now sacked advisor, Steve Bannon, who in that American Prospect interview that led to his sacking, he basically was raising the alarm about the rise of China, suggesting the United States needs to go toe-to-toe with China sooner rather than later or suffer the consequences. So on the one hand, there's this belligerence coming out of Washington, and you would think that that would call for an augmentation, if you like, of the U.S. military. But then Mr. Trump, out of the other side of his mouth, is calling for a purge of transgender troops who number conservatively in the thousands. So once again, Mr. Trump is trying to have it both ways. He's being as incoherent and inconsistent as ever, but I'm afraid to say that there are those in our community who may pay the ultimate price for this kind of wayward policy.
Yes, it seems that Trump acts as if the military card is the only one that he has to play, and some folks think that really reflects the state of U.S. imperialism, that it only has a military card to play.
Well, that's true. I mean, obviously, if you look at the economic indicators, the United States is beginning to lag behind. It's clear that China's in the passing lane, and I think that'll become ever more evident when the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa meet in China in a few days. And of course, there's going to be a BRICS Plus meeting. That is to say, they've invited other countries to attend, including, interestingly enough, Mexico, in light of Mr. Trump's attempt to break NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is causing consternation in Mexico City. Mexico has grown ever closer to China, and to a certain degree to Russia and Brazil, particularly in terms of trade relations with Brazil. And when the president of Mexico shows up in China in a few days, I think that that'll help to ratify that particular perception. It's also interesting to note that, according to the press account that I read, a number of African countries were also invited to this BRICS Plus meeting that'll be taking place, which should be engendering further hysteria, I'm sure, about the role of China, which is really only a stand-in. That is to say, this hysteria about the role of China is really only a stand-in for U.S. hysteria about the role of China generally. The kind of macho politics that exists in the United States makes it difficult for many to concede that the United States might be falling behind, so they express their concern about that reality by shedding crocodile tears about the alleged role of China in Africa. And if that perception that I've just articulated is accurate, you can expect a flood of crocodile tears after the BRICS Plus meeting in China in a few days, a flood that at least metaphorically might even exceed the flood waters that are now slowly receding on the Gulf Coast of Texas.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from Atlanta.
The U.S. war in Afghanistan is in its 16th year, a lot longer than that if you count all the years that Washington was funding what became Al-Qaeda at their bases in the country. The Trump administration has committed the U.S. to many more years of war in Afghanistan, which tends to prove the rule that once the U.S. occupies a country, it never leaves unless it is forced out. We spoke with Dr. Francis Boyle, the Distinguished Professor of International Law at the University of Illinois.
I think it's very clear that the United States used September 11, 2001 as a pretext to go out and try to steal as much oil and gas as they probably could and get away with around the world. I mean, look at everywhere we've gone. It's all about oil and gas and choke points for the shipment of oil and gas. That can explain our hostile policy right now against Venezuela. But Afghanistan, all these countries that we've attacked, taken over, destroyed, involve oil, gas, access to oil, gas. It seems pretty clear to me that's what's going on here. They come up with whatever pretext they want, humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect, weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the list of these things go on in terms of counterterrorism. And, you know, I've spent all my time since 9/11/2001 debunking all these so-called justifications and just pointing out it's just a raw, naked, brutal power grab by the American empire to control all the hydrocarbon resources in the world. I mean, that's what Somalia is all about, our amputation of South Sudan, our attack on Libya, Yemen there right near Saudi Arabia, and controlling the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, Iraq, Syria, access there and pipelines. You can go on forever. So I think that's really what's going on here, and that can account for this, you know, American hypermilitarism now since 9/11/2001.
Well, if strangulation and the controlling of choke points and the cutting off of nations that it considers to be competitors is what motivates the United States, then the Chinese response with their New Silk Road project seems to be the legal and nonviolent response.
Well, that's correct. And the Chinese are responding, as I see it, legally and economically to what we're doing militarily and criminally. And then Obama has targeted China. That's what his pivot against China is all about. And, you know, right now we have this very serious crisis related to North Korea. We're over there provoking these people. There are war maneuvers going on right now. We're threatening to attack them, invade them, decapitate them. But the bottom line, eventually all this is really directed against China and Chinese efforts to create their Silk Road and also their, I would say, natural dominance in Asia, which we're trying to stop. So for sure, Glenn, you're certainly correct about that.
The furious momentum of U.S. maneuvering and military activity, especially in the Pacific, the arena that President Obama made his historic shift to, seems to be affecting the operations of the U.S. fleet, which is now having great problems controlling its ships.
That's correct. We're all out there in the Pacific and certainly South China Sea engaging in all these hostile military maneuvers, so-called freedom of navigation operations and all the rest of it. And it does appear that the Navy out there is being run at a rate that they simply cannot keep up with, they cannot maintain, and they're a hazard to themselves and everyone out there. And we now see that with the loss of our own sailors, you know, on two ships now. But that all goes back to the great Obama and his pivot against China. I mean, you call it a pivot against Asia, but it's really a pivot against China and a hostile, provocative military maneuvers in that whole area. Sure. And that's all the Seventh Fleet. That's their job.
No one believes that Venezuela represents some kind of grave security threat to the United States. But whenever the U.S. invokes sanctions against Venezuela, it has to cite some kind of extreme threat.
Well, you know, it's total baloney. Glenn, you'd have to be an idiot to believe any of that. Venezuela is sitting on massive quantities of oil, the largest quantity of oil in Latin America. And that's why Bush Jr., I think it was, reactivated the Second Fleet to go down there and, if necessary, take out Venezuela and next door to it, Ecuador, that has, you know, these massive quantities of oil. And that's what's consistent with the policy I described to you after 9/11/2001. As a matter of fact, our hostile policies toward Venezuela violate the charter of the Organization of American States, to which the United States is a party, and prohibits any type of interference in their domestic affairs or any type of measures of economic coercion, such as sanctions against them or their president or their leaders. But, you know, international treaties and agreements, and by the way, the OAS standard charter establishes a higher standard of international law for the United States in dealing with our sister American republics than the United Nations charter does. But it does appear Mr. Trump and Tillerson and Pence really care about that. They're going for the oil. This has nothing to do with human rights in Venezuela. Where else does the Trump administration care about anyone's human rights? They're in the process now of trying to deport as many of these undocumented migrants here in America as they can. Now, ICE working full-time to throw them out, no matter their basic human rights, family rights, and things of this nature. You know, this is a joke and a fraud that we could give diddly squat about human rights in Venezuela. And indeed, we supported the coup against Chavez, and now it appears we're orchestrating some type of color revolution against Maduro. But again, it's all about oil and gas down there.
And in fact, it is those constraints imposed by treaties with South American countries that requires the United States to claim that it's facing an extraordinary security threat from Venezuela.
Well, that's just preposterous, right, Glenn? I mean, between you and me, where's the extraordinary threat to the United States of America here? But under U.S. domestic law, in order to adopt economic sanctions under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, then the president has to say under the National Emergencies Act, oh, well, we're facing some extraordinary threat to the United States of America. But it's all baloney. I think everyone knows that Venezuela is no threat to the United States. It's all about their oil. It's always been about oil in Venezuela. And I regret to say, Ben, that Ecuador is right next to them, and they have a massive quantity of oil, and they just had a new election there to replace Correa, and the new president, he's pretty independent too. So I think Ecuador is at risk as well. But right now, we haven't heard about that.
Yes, but Colombia, the United States' best friend in Latin America, has arguably one of the worst human rights records in the entire world.
Well, that's correct. I mean, you have massive repression there by the government of Colombia. One would hope that the FARC peace process is going to materialize and that will not continue. But again, we've never cared about, I mean, look at Trump's over there in Saudi Arabia doing the sword dance with the dictators of Saudi Arabia and their massive human rights violations over there. I mean, you know, it's hard to take seriously anything Trump says about promoting human rights anywhere in the world. Obama was far more deceptive. You know, I'd like to call Obama, you know, he was behind me at Harvard Law School. Obama was the black velvet glove covering the white racist iron fist of U.S. imperialism and capitalism around the world. Trump is just the iron fist. So you know what you're getting with Trump, that's for sure.
Neither one of the two major political parties in the United States has ever put international law at the top of its priorities or run election campaigns based on U.S. adherence to international law, except for the laws that they make up regarding, for example, responsibility to protect and humanitarian military intervention.
Well, you're right. Certainly in my political lifetime, which goes back to the Bay of Pigs under Kennedy and all up, international law, human rights has always been eyewash. Although I will make one slight modification in your statement, Glenn, in that, as I said, Obama was behind me at Harvard Law School. He's a magna cum laude graduate there. I am. And in his campaign statements running the first time for president, his statements were technically, legally correct. But once he got into power, he became just as lawless as Bush. You know, Obama left office, what, he was attacking seven or eight countries, and he spent 8 years continuously at warfare, longer than any president we had had. But Obama's campaign statements were fine in 2008, but, you know, once he got into power, he was, I would say he's even worse than Bush, and that, you know, even Bush never arrogated to himself some alleged right to murder United States citizens, as Obama did with the drone strikes there, murdering Mr. al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son. Now I note the al-Awlaki daughter is dead. So Obama was the one who officially endorsed the policy of murdering United States citizens.
Regarding Venezuelan sanctions, only three U.S. congressmen have come out against those sanctions, Congressman Conyers and two others. Doesn't seem to be a very high priority among even what's called the left of the Democratic Party.
Well, let me say this. I've worked with Congressman Conyers personally. I have great respect for him, and he's a man of integrity between you and me. But you're right about the rest of them. They're hopeless. They're all on the take, Democrats and Republicans. What's the difference, Glenn? I mean, ask African Americans what the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. What good have either the Democrats or the Republicans done for them? I don't see. I mean, I'm not African American myself, but I haven't seen all that much difference, except, you know, in terms of actual policies benefiting the economic condition of African Americans. We saw a lot of atmospherics by Obama, but in terms of practical policies, you know, I haven't seen that much difference. Obviously, African Americans have to draw your own conclusion, but certainly Congressman Conyers is a man of integrity, right?
The Trump administration has canceled, it says, the so-called secret, but everybody knew about it, CIA program in Syria, the CIA program to arm and train jihadists that was put in place under President Obama. But that administration seems to be doubling down on the conventional Pentagon involvement in Syria.
You're correct. It appears the CIA couldn't do the dirty job of illegally overthrowing the Assad government. And so they've decided now to have the Pentagon do it. And if you look at what's going on there, we are increasing the number of U.S. military forces in Syria, the tempo of military operations. The pretext is ISIS, but our military presence there is clearly illegal. We're helping carve up Syria, working with the Kurds and the Turks and others. And I think eventually there'll be a move on the Assad government, or at least some agreement with the Russians. The Russians have apparently said they're prepared to defend Damascus and their presence there. But I think it's only a question of time until right now. You know, effectively, Syria has been destroyed as a state, and our military is running wild all over Syria. And I think that's because the CIA couldn't do the job. So now they brought in the troops and the Air Force.
The Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party in its several iterations makes a lot of noise in terms of domestic programs, but seems to have no vision in terms of foreign policy.
Well, again, you're correct about that. Yeah, I think he does have a vision for here in America that's different from the standard party line by the Democrats and Republicans. But in terms of American imperialism, I haven't really seen Senator Sanders come out against it. And in all due respect, how can you run an empire abroad in this way and promote serious reform at home? You know, it was just like Lyndon Johnson with his Great Society and everything like that, and the war against poverty. And then meanwhile, he goes off and has this massive escalation in Vietnam. So what's left here at home? And I'm afraid that, you know, even if Senator Sanders were to become president, he'd probably continue to manage the U.S. empire abroad. And that would just continue to have a negative impact here at home. We'd be wasting billions and trillions of dollars running the empire, and starving our own people.
Dr. Francis Boyle, speaking from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Prison abolition advocates rallied in cities recently under the banner Millions for Prisoners' Human Rights. The activists maintained that the U.S. prison system is just another form of slavery. The biggest event was held in Washington, D.C. We'll hear from three speakers. The first is Laura Whitehorn, who served 14 years in federal prison on political charges. Whitehorn is with the Northeast Political Prisoners Coalition.
We have heard some profound analysis today of how white supremacy and imperialism work hand in hand. This is a white settler colony. This land was stolen from Native Americans, and it was given life by stolen African slaves. We are part of an international struggle, though. And we have to remember that. So I want to bring into this space all of the Palestinian political prisoners who stand with us. The country of the government of Israel and the government of the United States work hand in hand because they are mirror images of each other. And Israel incarcerates the same level of people. If you look at Palestine, they incarcerate Palestinians. They don't incarcerate Israelis very much, but they incarcerate one out of every, I think it's five, Palestinian men has been in prison. So we have to make international demands, demand that BDS should never be criminalized,
we should
boycott, and we should stand in solidarity with our Palestinian sisters and brothers. Free Palestine, free all political prisoners, abolish the prison system, and abolish imperialism.
Up next, we have got my dear friend, Ms. Tomiko Shawn. She is with the Asian People in Prisons Human Rights Campaign and a Baltimore native. Irena Purdy, 39 years in prison, state of Maryland. Shahid Ali, 50 years, Washington, D.C., died 4 months after release. Patty Pruitt, state of Missouri, 30-plus years, left 5 children behind. Joseph Ligon, 50 years plus in the state of Pennsylvania penitentiary. Sheldry Topp, in prison right now, over 50 years in the state of Michigan. Dr. Lois Farquharson, 40 plus years in the state of Pennsylvania, died not knowing where she was and why she was there. Suniata Okoli, over 40 years in prison, 80 years old, told to come back in 15 years for his parole. Move 9, 30-plus years, state of Pennsylvania, left behind generations of children, grandchildren. Philip Chance, Alabama, 30-plus years, partnered by 2 governors of Michigan, died in prison. Innocent man. Youssef, state of Maryland, did 40-plus years, died that evening he was released from prison. John McKenzie, 40-plus years, New York, his 10th parole denial, he committed suicide. Aging people in prison. My name is Tomiko. By training, I'm a cultural anthropologist, and this is what I do. I work to try to get those elderly people out of prison who is incarcerated young. But where do we begin? Do we begin with the 13th Amendment? Or does it really begin with the people who was brought from another continent, across the ocean, in ships? This was the first prison. In the bowels, dying, throwing themselves over because the life that they were going to go, a living death, they said death is better than any living death. This is the first prison of a people of African descent. Then they were taken to the plantations, the second prison, born into slavery, children born into slavery, generational slavery. And here we come, 2017 will be called prisons, mass incarceration, but really generational incarceration, where you have 2 and 3 generations of men and women missing from one family. Who have we become? What are we supposed to do? And so Asian People in Prison, Human Rights Campaign that I helped lead with these esteemed folks behind me, the crime is not the original crime. The crime is how long they have been incarcerated, away from their family, away from their children. The Emancipation Proclamation, they had a chance to shut down white supremacy. But I want to add an amendment, and an amendment is a disclaimer.
Right.
Add it to a contract. It's not for the other person. It's for you. I want something extra. And so this is the 13th Amendment, and so here we are. But how do we begin to get these people back? They have them return. And so we want reparatory justice.
Yes.
We want reparations now.
Yes.
We want them in the form of living bodies.
Yes.
Return to the families.
Yes.
To the children.
Yes.
We want in the form of living bodies.
Yes.
And to do this type of work, to free somebody for liberation, is a spiritual act.
Yes.
Because we are all creations of a creator.
Yes.
It is a spiritual act. And so today we call upon the ancestors,
yes,
to help freedom,
yes,
and to free us all.
That's right.
And we ask that you all join us in this by raising your fist and stomping your foot and making a loud sound to make the walls of Jericho fall.
Yeah.
We want the walls of Jericho to fall
because right.
We want these living bodies returned to us today. And as we begin to rebuild what the human spirit demands, no prisons for our children, for our mothers, for our fathers.
Yeah.
And so this is what we want. We want you to give them back.
Yeah.
We want you to give them back to us.
Yes.
What's been taken from us. We want our reparations in the form of living bodies.
Yeah.
And anytime a seven-year-old says, I ask him what he want to be, he said, well, I probably end up growing up and going to jail like my father. Baltimore, Maryland lives on Curry Streets. What a seven-year-old says, then it's done. Then we have to act. Reparations now,
yeah,
in the form of living bodies,
yeah,
you give them back.
You give them back.
You give them back.
You give them back.
Thank you.
Please help me welcome my good friend, Brother Max Parthas. Come on up here, Max. He is a word warrior, a spoken word artist, an activist, a freedom lover, a free thinker, abolitionist, and someone who just plain gives a damn. Max is also the host of New Abolitionist Radio. Take it away, Max.
Washington, D.C. Right over there is the heart of the most power on earth that man possesses, right there. Washington, D.C., how the hell are you? My name is Max Parthas. I'm just a regular guy. But I've been studying this for all of my life. My sons have spent collectively 32 years behind bars. My brothers, two of them, spent over 30 years behind bars. I have six children. The odds they say and that they tell me to tell my kids is that one in three of them can be expected to spend time in prison. And I'm here to tell you that that statistic does apply. It applied to me. I have 15 grandchildren. Right now, my youngest daughter is in labor. It's going to be number 16. That means that five of my children at least are going to go to prison. I am not having that. If you're not having that, let me hear some noise. I want to put these things into perspective because I feel some kind of way today. I'm very proud of what happened today, and I've also had disappointing moments. And I'm not one to cut my words or pretend to be something I'm not. I'm just a real brother that's going to say it like I mean it. And I know what the hell I'm talking about. And I hope that you give me the respect of listening to me today. Can I get that from you guys?
Yeah.
If you got some video cameras, if you got a phone, you might want to start filming this. Share it with somebody later on because this is going to make a difference. So let's put this in perspective. We're talking about slavery. We're not talking about pretend slavery. We're not talking about mental slavery. We're not talking about economic slavery. We're talking about where they hunt your ass in the street. Them men right there. Hunt your ass in the street. Pick you up like they got shopping carts. Take you into these prisons. Put you on a bed like a slab of meat that will earn these prisons anything from $50,000 a year up to $100,000 a year per person put into these prison cells. Right now. See, we asked, or the organizers asked the people here today as representatives to speak a little bit about the 13th Amendment. Some of them got up here and told us how none of this is going to work. Some of them got up here and told us how we were just having a march, and when we finish with this march, we got to continue doing the work like this ain't important right here, right now, today.
Yeah.
Some of them got up here and told us we were wasting our time. I'm not feeling that at all. Let me tell you what's going on here today. This is the largest gathering of slavery abolitionists in the history of the United States happening right here today. In 16 cities across America, they are marching in unison with us and in solidarity with us, and they're not doing it to end mass incarceration. They're doing it to end what? Slavery. See, y'all don't know what the hell slavery is apparently these days. I just pointed out to you how it works. Well, how did it come into play? The 13th Amendment Exception Clause traces all the way back to 1777 Vermont. It's in their constitution right now where they say that prisoners shall be duly convicted except for, it says slavery shall be abolished in the state of Vermont except for prisoners duly convicted or in case of debts or the like. What the hell is the like? Like you could be a slave for being the like in the state of Vermont. They were the first ones to put it out. From Vermont in 1777, it went over to Alabama. From Alabama, it went in Ohio. Those three states adopted what was the predecessor of the 13th Amendment. By 1865, it had gotten to Abraham Lincoln. Do y'all know Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer? Do you trust lawyers?
No.
Come on now. Abraham was Lincoln was a lawyer. He was in the middle of a civil war that it was impending at one point, and then it actually happened. He was looking for a way to solve the problem between the North and the South. In a letter to Justice Stevens in 1862, I believe, he said clearly to him what the difference between the North and the South was. When he told Justice Stevens, "You in the South think that slavery is a right that should be allowed to all, and us in the North think that it should be restricted." That is the only difference between us. Now, what did he mean by restricted? He was talking about convict leasing. He was talking about what occurred in 1865 when the North won the war and they put convict leasing into effect immediately. Where I come from, in South Carolina, they built that first prison there in 1866 and are proudly bragging about it. Within 2 years, many of these prisons across the South went from 90% white to guess what? 90% black. The people who were supposedly freed were immediately rearrested under black codes and pig laws and put right back in those damn cells where they were leased out to the railroad mines, leased out to the coal factories, leased out to the plantations where they were just slaves at. And this was happening after the so-called emancipation. After the 13th Amendment, this went on. It went on all the way to 1928 in Alabama. In Alabama in 1928, there was a cave-in that took the lives of 128 black men, women, and children. They were being leased out to this mine, to work in this mine for free. Many of them picked up because they didn't have money in their pocket and was in somebody else's town, because they looked at a white woman wrong, because they spit on the ground, because they were black. As simple as that. And then they leased these men and women out to these companies and built what you call America right now.
Yeah.
Now, if that's not slavery, I don't know what the hell is. See, the difference is, prior to 1865, the individual, as the letter proclaimed, could own people. After 1865, the transfer of ownership of your behind went from the individual to the state owning people. And they kept those people in those cages because taxpayers would pay for their upkeep. There's a book by the name of One Dies, Get Another by Jay Mancini. And in that book, it's titled One Dies, Get Another, Jay Mancini, Prison Leasing in the United States, 1866 to 1928. In that book, he says, the only difference between slavery and convict leasing was with criminals so plentiful they were seen as disposable. They didn't have any care of taking care of them anymore. And this wasn't before 1865. This was after 1865. So I'm telling you that went on until 1928. And the way they do things here is they transform slavery. They always transform it into something else and call it another name. And people get up here and start talking about how slavery is mass incarceration, how slavery is justice for sale, how slavery is over-policing, how slavery is injustice in the courts, racism. I don't give a damn about no racism. I give a damn about slavery. Without slavery, those races wouldn't have a damn power. They wouldn't have the power they have right now. They wouldn't have it. They couldn't do anything to you. But right now, those men can come over here, put a gun in my face, and put me in a jail cell any damn time they feel like it. And they represent white supremacy. The next stage of slavery was Unicor. Unicor is one company. Anybody here familiar with Unicor? It's a $1 billion a year business that was established in 1936 as a replacement after convict leasing. All they provide is prison labor. They have 109 factories making 170 some odd products, but the factories are built into the prison. You hear what I'm telling you? Built into the damn prison. $1 billion a year service. Now, in the 80s, well, actually, let's go to the 70s. I want to do it real quick. In the 70s, we know Nixon, everybody knows he was a racist. Anybody confused about Nixon being a racist? All right. In the 70s, this racist president started what was called the War on Drugs, right before he resigned, right? And we know today that Nixon admitted that he was doing it to target blacks and anti-war protesters. He said, basically, you know, we can't physically target them and get away with it, but we can associate the blacks with heroin and the war protesters with marijuana, and then we can go in and tear their communities apart. And they did that, and the first of what we call mass incarceration started to come up. The next stage was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan came in and said, you know what? This whole thing about people being not being able to own people anymore sucks. I want to change that. So he invited a private prison to build a facility in Louisiana, a women's prison. For the first time since 1865, the average person could now go online or go to their stockbroker and buy stocks in prison. When you buy stocks in prison, do you think you're buying prisons? Do you think you're buying a room? Do you think you're buying the blankets? You are buying the people. You are putting your money, your investments, into the fact that those prisons will be filled all the damn time. And it's not just filled to 100%. In Alabama right now, where they are also protesting in solidarity, it's at 200% capacity right now. 200%. We have instances in our history recently that should be worldwide scandals, but nobody's talking about it. Have you ever heard of the Kids for Cash scandal?
Yeah.
Kids for Cash, right?
Yeah.
What was happening was in Pennsylvania, two judges were working with a private for-profit prison by the name of Merkel. Merkel was the developer. The two judges were working an assembly line of human trafficking and slavery where they had incarcerated nearly 5,000 children for pay. Merkel was giving these judges money to send these children to their prisons. The judges was earning millions. Merkel made nearly $1 billion. The way it ended was the judges got 28 years in prison and the company got fined $80 million. Now, if you made $1 billion and you got fined $80 million, do you feel like it was a bad day?
No.
No. So for selling children, they didn't get no time. The Supreme Court had to overturn all of those convictions. Some of these children were in there for something as little as throwing a piece of steak at their stepfather, writing on their desk, or making fun of their vice principal. They weren't given trials. They weren't given representation. They were simply ushered right into a prison for a kickback.
Max Parthas was referring to a ring of crooked judges in Pennsylvania. Wilbur Jess, the poet Sanders, is locked up in Pennsylvania's McCain Federal Prison. Sanders submitted this piece of poetry to Prison Radio. It's called Politically Incorrect.
Lately, the so-called United States are heavily divided and tainted with hate. A deadly tension pollutes the air, creating a lethal and toxic atmosphere. After analyzation of race relations throughout this extremely brutal nation, it's obvious residents of today's society are victims of moral bankruptcy. It's evident the president is insufficient, speaks nothing to alleviate the predicament. This is a period where aggression grows, hatred and hostility consistently flows. Government officials deliberately mislead us, leaving the masses with no one to trust. By hesitating to denounce white supremacy, Trump condones acts of bigotry. Since the start of his administration, there's been intense investigations exposing cover-ups and conspiracy, plus collusion with Russian enemies. The blind can see Trump is unfit or inadequate for a future in politics. Members of his cabinet are constantly fighting because of his rhetoric and vicious backbiting. Trump is vindictive with a cold heart, and time he'll tear this country apart. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.